Welcome to the Arrangers Podcast. I'm Aaron Hedenstrom.
And I'm Drew Zaremba. The Arrangers Podcast is dedicated to the insightful discussion of music arranging and composition.
What we do takes a lot of hard work and resources. We are asking for support from listeners like you to continue to make this podcast available for everybody.
Please consider contributing a monthly donation to our Patreon platform. We sincerely appreciate any contributions you are able to give. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or leave a review on iTunes.
Be sure to send us your questions and feedback to thearrangerspodcast@gmail.com and find out more at www.thearrangerspodcast.com.
Let's dive in.
Wait a second.
Did you just hear that?
Yeah, wait a second. Roll it again.
Yeah, no, that was right.
That's rhythmining.
That's a Thelonious Monk tune, isn't it?
Yes, but this is Mary Lou Williams, as many of you know, of course. This is Walkin' and Swingin' by the incomparable Mary Lou Williams, whom the episode is about. And it's been a real pleasure for both of us getting to dig into her incredible music over the last couple weeks here, hasn't it, Aaron?
It sure has, Drew. It's pretty incredible. And what you just heard was a clip from Walkin' and Swingin', 1936 composition, years before Rhythmining was written by Thelonious Monk. And I think it's a really illustrative example of just how influential Mary Lou Williams was in the entire scope of jazz history.
Right. She was basically everywhere. She actually prides herself in an interview with Marion McPartland as being a woman who played through all eras of jazz. She says, you know, other people lived through it, but didn't change their style. But she takes with a note of pride that she played through and absorbed part of the style of each era of jazz from its very beginning to the modern era, basically.
Absolutely. And what's incredible about that is that she was not only a really accomplished pianist, band leader, and small group player, improviser, but a prolific arranger and composer. And what we just heard was an example of something that she did earlier on in her career, but we're going to listen and analyze a couple of her later pieces that are very different in compositional style to what we just listened to as the intro track, which I think is really great because it just shows how adaptive she was, you know, how much she contributed to the progressive development of jazz style.
Right. Yeah. She had a huge hand in shaping the sound of the big band era. She was playing for Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy as a teenager. And one of her first hits for that group was a piece called Froggy Bottom. And there's a number of amazing things about it. Of course, it was very much in the style of the time, but that was kind of her first hit. She recalls in books and in interviews writing anywhere from 5 to 12 arrangements every week for different bands in Kansas City, in Missouri, in Chicago, in New York City. And she became a powerhouse writer and then ended up writing for Benny Goodman's orchestra as well. And her big hit for them was a piece called Roll 'em. Let's Roll 'em.
And actually, Benny Goodman wanted to have her be his exclusive arranger, but she instead chose to go her own direction and freelance. But one of her other big collaborators was Dizzy Gillespie and his big band with the song The Land of Obladi.
I met a beautiful princess in the land of Obladi. She smiled and said, Obadilia, meaning you appeal to me.
Yeah, and then through working with Dizzy Gillespie, she, because of her experience and coming in with such a wealth of knowledge of arranging and piano playing, She became a mentor to Charlie Parker, to Dizzy Gillespie, to Thelonious Monk. And like we alluded to earlier in the show, Monk honored her by using part of the quote from her piece Walkin' and Swingin' as the basis of his own composition, Rhythmining, while she was in New York at this time. And she also became kind of a protege and collaborator with Duke Ellington as well, and wrote a number of pieces for the Duke Ellington Orchestra, including most famously her arrangement of Blue Skies, which Duke later renamed Trumpets Without End because of its incredible trumpet writing to feature the section.
So as you could hear, there were plenty of trumpets on that one.
Yes, one might say they weren't ending.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible just to read a list of Mary Lou Williams' awards and honors. She won two Guggenheim Fellowships in 1972 and 1977. She was a nominee for the 1971 Grammy Awards for the album Giants. She has an honorary degree from Fordham University in New York. The list goes on and on and on, but she was a prolific educator, performer, and, you know, you can't say enough about her legacy.
Yeah, to consider her anything less than one of the great jazz composers of all time would be a disservice to her incredible skill and abilities as a pianist and composer and arranger. Hence why we had the great pleasure of doing this episode on her and taking the opportunity to delve into her career and then these next two pieces. And this is actually, since we left off with the Duke Ellington piece, that she wrote a piece for Duke Ellington, that is, now would be a good time to, I think, jump into our first piece of the two that we're going to analyze. And that is this very incredible piece of music called Scorpio.
So you just heard a clip of the 1946 piece by Mary Lou Williams entitled Scorpio. So Drew, you just played this with your big band at the University of Northern Colorado. And I wanted to ask you, as you were studying, preparing, rehearsing, and performing this piece, what stands out to you?
My goodness. Yeah, it was a real pleasure programming this for UNC's Lab One. And it's such a different piece from so much of what you would expect something to sound like in 1946. You know, like, especially given just so much of her music was strophic and, you know, follows a form and has some degree of, you know, expectation of bebop harmony. Of course, she had written the Zodiac Suite at this point for her trio and had transitioned a number of them into arrangements, some of them for a reduced orchestra, jazz orchestra with strings and bassoons and oboes, and then other pieces for a big band like this one. This one, of course, for Duke Ellington's big band. I was just struck by how modern it is, how not 1946 it sounds like. This piece sounds like it could have been written yesterday, honestly. And just the continuity of the ideas while still feeling very fresh and in the moment. Of course, it's a through-composed piece. And to me, it's kind of marked by four sections, four events. Mm. And in the performance, I was trying to figure out how do we link these four events together in a way that honors the music, but kind of brings them together in a cohesive way a little bit. And that it was just a joy to get as much expression out of the band as possible, getting the maximum amount of dynamic out of this. It's a very dramatic, and it goes between this kind of bass line and the harmony being so aggressive, and then this beautiful trombone solo, just so romantic and beautiful. It's a really going back and forth between polar opposites. And so I think that's part of the draw of the piece to me.
Interesting. Yeah, so I haven't studied it to the level that you were able to, but I'm struck by all the different directions it goes within 5.5 minutes or six minutes.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, it goes through several keys and orchestration changes and themes and general thematic sections. And one of the things that I think really distinguishes more modern writing is that it can be a little bit more event driven, like you said. I like that where you said it's kind of driven by four events. That's one of the things that I think makes it difficult to study, but it's really cool to just listen to how it stays fresh. I mean, the tempo stays the same the entire time, and it's a slower tempo in the piece. It's hard to make a slow tempo last 6 minutes and stay fresh, you know? And there's no question to me that it stays fresh. And what really stuck out to me was the use of different solo timbres, how it starts off with this beautiful clarinet line, and then midway through the piece, it switches to a really nice high trombone solo that kind of gives it a little change of pace, and then the piano solo. It's really cool how it uses the solo instruments to create some different textural changes.
Yes. With that, I think let's dive deep into this piece and really take a look at some of the things that are really unique about this piece. Of course, it starts out with this incredibly stark and haunting intro with the solo clarinet. It's like, it just sets the mood. Ooh, this is going to be mysterious and dramatic. Like, oh my goodness. And I love her voicings. I have the fortune of having the full score in front of me here, but these are not typical big band voicings. There's plenty of dissonances in different places. We'll talk about how she uses augmented triads and chordal voicings and other shapes to great effect. But for me, it's the main stark contrast between the clarinet and the full ensemble. Like, wow. And then we get into the first event here, which is this just haunting bass line. And I don't, for me, it's outlining B flat and then flat two, basically, in the second half of the bar. Do you hear that any different way, Aaron, maybe?
That's how I heard it too.
Right. But the cool thing is, over all of this, Mary Lou creates all sorts of, she treats it like a pedal point, really. Even though it's a sufficient harmonic progression within itself, it becomes a pedal point within a bass line that then she brings all this other harmonic color on top of it. It starts with just the melody, the solo clarinet, and it's so effective because she just lingers on these really tense notes with kind of short angular phrases in between. And it's so effective and haunting. But then the pedal point really comes into play when the triads come in the trombones. That kind of stuff, which of course is, you know, how Ellington used those trombones at times in some of his slower pieces. I'm thinking of the Far East Suite in particular. Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that she was perhaps had studied some of this with Ellington, or maybe even inspired some of what he was doing.
yeah. Well, it's interesting because what you were just playing just sounded to my ear like the intro of So What off of Kind of Blue. And a lot of the bass lines in this piece we were discussing as we were kind of talking through this also remind me of bass lines off of that record, Kind of Blue. You know, boo doo doo doo. Kind of reminds me of All Blues, you know?
Right, yeah.
And if you think about how that was, you know, 15 years after this piece was written, there's certainly some influence there, knowing that, you know, Mary Lou is very much a mentor to the musicians that put that record together.
Right, yeah. I actually need to correct myself because I'm just realizing that the Far East Suite was released in 1966 and came out of Duke Ellington's tour, I believe, in the early 60s. So perhaps very well that she influenced him in this way.
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, but anyways, and then of course, each section has its climax, which I think is what makes each section kind of stand out on itself. It comes in with that big trumpet 2D thing on the B flat diminished. And that's the conclusion of the first section. And then we get into, so this is like the mysterious. And then we get into this gorgeous texture, complete orchestration change. Instead of the clarinet and the bass line, we suddenly sweep into trombone, high trombone with arco bass, subtone saxophones, and alluding to all of these beautiful harmonic, very Billy Strayhorn-esque romantic harmonies, all in the key of B flat minor, but actually never ever resolving to B flat minor, which I think keeps the forward momentum of this going the whole time.
And then, Drew, is this written as a piano solo specifically, or is this sort of an open section that has some degree of choice? Because in the recording, it's the U.S. Army Field Band Jazz Ambassadors, The Legacy of Mary Lou Williams. It's a piano solo by Jerry Allen.
Right, yes.
But is that something specifically written in the chart?
Having written this for the Duke Ellington Orchestra, she wrote this to feature, at this point in the chart anyways, Duke himself, and it's possible that they would have opened it up, but they actually never performed this. Upon Duke hearing it, as the legend goes, that Duke thought it was too modern for his band.
Wow.
And so he never recorded it, or it was never in rotation in normal performance. And so it's hard to say, but in their interpretation, I think it really works well opening up, because then it becomes kind of a piano feature for the rest of the piece. In the original score, it became a feature for Ray Nance later in the piece, Duke Ellington here, and then Ray Nance to take the last portion of the piece on violin, which would have been a very interesting timbral choice.
Wow.
But it just to bring it down to the trio right here, the piano, bass, and drums, to really cleanse the palate and bring in what you are hearing as the all blues.
Mm-hmm.
Very much that. And it reminds us of its immediate relationship, of course, not particularly far off either, because B flat being in the key of D flat major, not only one flat away from G flat major. So it feels like we're going back in a sense to the original theme, especially with the bass doubled with the left hand piano there. But this becomes an opportunity to feature Duke Ellington, and the ensemble has little comments throughout. I love the gesture at measure 51. The voicings are gorgeous. The new chord for each bass note gives it a ton of motion and a ton of color. And because it's quarter note triplets, we really hear each chord as it resolves as we get back to G flat major. And then the fact that it's in two different orchestrations helps it feel fresh each time.
Speaking of your recent observation about the relationship between all the different bass lines in this piece, that's another thing that I really noticed, is how bassline driven this is. And
yes,
I think about a lot of pieces by Bob Brookmeyer or Jim McNeely or some of these more modern composers of the last, few decades, and very much, coming from that tradition. And I think it's really cool to trace that back to, 1946, this piece having this sort of highly orchestrated bass ostinato texture featured all over the place.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and this classic texture of the left hand of the piano with the bass as well.
Right, yeah. And then later it's joined by Barry Sachs, which I think, is just such a fresh texture.
Probably one of my favorite moments in the piece is when, at the end of the third section here, at the end of the piano solo part, when we have these chordal voicings in the trombones over the bass line.
Mm.
and then over suspend it. So that's already two layers, right? And then the third layer are these straight mute trumpets in this very kind of romantic gesture. And it's just beautiful. Yeah, it's one of my personal favorite moments. And then, and finally, to wrap things up, it ends similarly to how it begins. We go back to our first bass line. And on the recording that we've been referencing from the Army Ambassadors, it's a piano solo, but the original, like we mentioned, was for violinist Ray Nance, who, of course, also played trumpet in the band. So that was, again, all of these suspended harmonies over the bass line. They're really quite something. it's a heck of a progression, and it implies a number of different motions. And then finally, the conclusion, this epic chord, D7 in the trumpets, over D augmented in the trombones, over an E flat bass.
Wow.
It's, yeah, it like, what a wonderful...
So
I
good.
Love this. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's really, you know, reminds me, a number of things in this remind me of classical music, the stark orchestration, and then this last chord, kind of a Straussian bitonal moment. Whether she was being influenced by those things, I would imagine to a certain degree, yes. But what I just love about this score is how it just shows her depth. It shows, yes, of course, she could write, you know, Walking and Swinging, an incredible melody and very sophisticated in parts. But then she could also let loose on this other piece on Scorpio here and do a number of very adventurous things that were even too adventurous for Duke Ellington at the time. How marvelous is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing. When we were studying Duke Ellington's music for another one of these episodes, one of the things that was really obvious was the use of heavy chromaticism. And that's why there's so much tonal color in the compositions. And I think that's something you see in this music as well, is just a heavy dose of chromatic voicings, you know, that pedal point thing where you stick in one key in the bass, but then you move the chord around in the voicings above that. What a great way to create some tension without losing your sense of groundedness. And honestly, the sense of the blues that is present within yes. this piece as well. You know, I mean, if you just check out some of her piano recordings, she was really a clinician of blues and stride piano.
Yes.
So you can definitely hear that there's a very strong foundation in blues, soul, and gospel music in this as well. I know that's something that's very, very powerful to us, you know, listening to that influence in the music. So I really enjoy that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's just scratching the surface, in my opinion, of Scorpio. But we hope you enjoyed our little analysis here. It was not actually too many years after this that her mentee and dear friend Charlie Parker died. And it was at this point in her life that she actually decided to, she quit music for a number of years. Mary Lou converted to Catholicism, moved to Europe, and basically prayed, fed the poor, and did saintly things for a number of years before a number of priests encouraged her to go back to music. And then my understanding is she went and talked about and wrote a number of sacred pieces for choir and piano and things like this, and then eventually began a new career doing jazz and performing piano. And that's the context of this next piece that we're going to be looking at.
Thank you. So we just listened to a clip from the piece Shafi, recorded in 1977 by the Dutch Radio Big Band. And this was written as a tribute to the saxophonist Shafi Hadi, who was a saxophonist for Charles Mingus, among other players. And just speculating here, but it's a pretty saxophone-driven piece.
Very much so.
The melody is played by the saxophones. The bridge section of the kind of the first half of the piece is played by kind of a very emotive saxophone solo. And then the solo section, at least on this recording, is a Barry sax solo. So yeah, I would say this piece was really fun to study because it sounds like modal jazz, you know, in the vein of Coltrane Quartet or Freddie Hubbard, you know, 1960s type piece, or any number of other musicians from that era. But this was one of the last pieces she wrote towards the end of her life, and I think it's a really incredible piece. It's super adventurous, I think.
Yes. Yeah, it really is. It demonstrates her own quote about herself, that she lived through and played all the different styles of jazz through her entire life. Like, this, it really sounds nothing like Walking and Swinging. It's or Roll'em, or even like Scorpio, for that matter. This is very much coming out of, like, it. This sounds like you know, a lot, like you said, a lot of influence from John Coltrane, Joe Henderson, McCoy Tyner, this kind of approach, and yet still very much distinctively her. Just the sheer power of the chords, some of the voicings planing here and there, and then, well, I'll let you talk about it more, but for me, I just love that bridge in the middle.
Yeah.
So that's the romanticism, I feel. It's just so pretty.
Yeah, it definitely kind of breaks into a different character there, which is nice as a contrast, so that the piece isn't just one-dimensional. You know, it goes into a slow halftime swing with a really cool chromatic line under the melody. Like, it has all the hallmarks of classic modal jazz harmonic and melodic sounds.
Yes.
You know, the melody is, you know, super fourth space.
Yes.
You know, and then it kind of breaks into a expansion of that. Another person that kind of reminds me of is Eddie Harris.
Oh, he's yes, kind of very much based, so.
You know, freedom jazz dance, that kind of thing. And then you have the brass playing these power chords, G minor. You know, that's that modal sound as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then with these planing, chromatic planing, parallel voicings in the brass.
Yes.
You know, again, it's that pedal point thing that was also a technique used in the last piece we looked at, but used differently, of course. And one thing that really glues this piece together motivically, and as I was looking at this, I started noticing it all throughout the piece, is simply the idea of a whole step in terms of harmonic motion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this very beginning section, the brass planes up this voicing in a whole step, then down in a whole step.
Yes.
And then later on in the bridge,
yes,
the progression goes F minor, you know, with this down a whole step to E flat minor, back up. So it's kind of oscillating between chords a whole step away, and then it goes up a fourth from the E flat to A flat and then G flat. So it's going A flat, oscillating between those whole steps. And then in the solo section, what's interesting about this is the solo section is based on an entirely different set of chords than any of the other part of the piece.
Yeah.
It's so you could kind of almost ask yourself, you know, well, what does it have to do with the rest of the piece? I think personally it's the whole step movement, because the solo section G minor 9, F minor 9,
yes.
G minor 9. So it's kind of oscillating again between these parallel whole step chords. And then it goes into G flat major 7 to E major 7.
Right.
Whole step away. You know, which...
And then B to A major 7.
Yep, B yeah, to A, and then back to G to F. So I think this whole step root movement from one chord to the next is a thematic, even though it's, you wouldn't say that, you know, chord changes are necessarily a melodic theme, but it's a thematic element of the structure of the piece that I think ties it together. And if you're listening yes. to it, you may not even, you probably wouldn't recognize that that's the element tying it together because, you know, it's subtle, but it's, once you start looking at it, you start seeing it all over the place. It's really, really neat.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the moments I love is the end of the A sections. And then at the end of the bridge is the resting on this giant Phrygian chord. It's a very bold move after a whole step. And yes. then that's just, I think a lesser composer would have opted for a more conventional cadence at that point, you know?
Yeah.
But something, maybe even just G5 or
right.
G minor 6-9. But no, Mary Lou's like, no, not enough. We're going for the jugular here.
Yeah, yeah.
Very aggressive and... what a beautiful, just a great sound. Very, you know, that's this, isn't that a Spanish, sort of a Spanish cadence to end on a Phrygian chord?
Yeah.
Even though it's usually a five chord in a Spanish cadence, but this is kind of a one chord, but it's acting like a five chord. And I just loved that sound. That was one of my favorite moments.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, that bridge, and beautiful pointing out, the whole step is also... in the melody as well. It's kind uh-huh. of like if you were to look at the big picture, it's almost parallel ninths, you know, between uh-huh. the melody and the, so it's there in the melody as well.
I think what's interesting is this bridge section in the opening, you know, couple of minutes of the piece. It sounds very film noir to me, you know.
Ah.
And it's got these really like dark, you know.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is, you know, most of the piece you have these dense chord voicings, you know,
yes,
with these half
yes,
steps.
Yes.
And these big chords and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Lots of notes. And then all of a sudden, you just have complete and utter unison. I mean, you have, you know, a bass note on at low F at the start of it.
Right.
But then literally everyone else, including the bass player, is playing just unison on this chromatic line. I mean, it's like... You don't even really think of it as simple, but it's very simple.
Yes.
But it just shows you how simplicity can come off as more complex when it's done in an orchestrational way, you know?
Right.
It's
very effective.
One of my favorite parts. Yeah.
Yeah. The polyphony is so effective after all this unison and homophony. Like it's, yeah, you're right. It is simple, but it's different enough and it's melodic, you know, it's really three melodies in a sense.
Yeah. And then the solo form, I mean, it's a 22 bar form, so it's far from conventional.
Yeah. Easy. Yeah, yeah, no big deal, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think going forward, I'm going to use this piece as like a textbook on modal jazz writing because it's just got all the elements, you know, that you want to see in a piece like this. It's really really a cool piece.
Yeah. The shout chorus is so dope too.
Yes. Oh, I mean, those rhythms, you know, all those
yes.
triplets.
Yeah.
And it never really goes back to the beginning. It just kind of it kind of hints at it, but it does a variation on it. It never directly states the opening again. You know, it's very, yeah, very composed.
Yeah, it is. That gorgeous bridge material is never used again, which is a very bold, like it really makes it stand out to me. Mm-hmm. It becomes very memorable. I think that's part of where the solo form comes from, is a little bit those changes at the bridge. You know, obviously it's not, you know, entirely whatsoever.
They're not the exact notes, but it's definitely
the gesture.
The gesture of that whole step. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that shout, yeah, some of those 16th notes at this tempo are very aggressive. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then those, you know, those fourths and shifting the fourths into chromatic things at the last line of the piece and the saxes, you know.
Yeah, it's so great.
Do-ba-dum-do-ba-dum, or whatever that is, you know, we'll play the clip. You know, it's just, I mean, who doesn't want to play that, you know? Which saxophone section in a big band wouldn't want to play that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know. I think this will be the next Mary Lou Williams piece that we do, if I have any say about it.
Yeah, and I also love the, I'm a sucker for this Mozambique swing thing that you hear Elvin Jones do that is used here. But I just love that, you know, it's infectious.
Very much so.
Well, I am incredibly inspired to write more music now because of studying Mary Lou Williams' music and really digging into the incredible technique and imagination of these pieces.
Yes, it's incredibly inspiring, very, really unique. And just the fact that she's able to do so many different styles of music so well is also inspirational. I think a lot of people get pinned as having one sound, you know, or maybe a couple sounds. Oh yeah, that's what that person sounds like. And the truth is, no one is just one sound, right? Like, we're all a diversity of experiences. But I think especially as composers get older and find out what they like, they tend to write a lot in that style. This could not be further from the truth for someone like Mary Lou Williams. Her incredible range from the beginning of her career to the end. We didn't even touch on some of her sacred pieces, which go into a totally different realm. Is truly inspiring and something we can all gain from. We can all do a number of different things with our musical gifts that we have.
Yeah, and I mean, I wanted to just touch on her taking some time off of music. That to me is really impressive, because I don't know about you, but I can imagine, you know, if I took some time off of music, I might feel incredibly insecure that maybe I would never come back, or maybe right. I would be losing something, or losing out, or missing out on something that I could be experiencing. But just the fact that, you know, the totality of the person, you know, was so important to her. And I wanted to bring up this quote that I found, that where she says, "Anything you are shows up in your music. Jazz is whatever you are, playing yourself, being yourself, letting your thoughts come through." And I just think that's a beautiful summary of, you know, what the compositional process is, to me at least. I just love this idea that, you know, your music speaks more from your soul than it does out of your technique or out of your, you know, schooling. It's really a wonderful idea to think that, you know, our music is more than just notes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. I think that's a perfect place to end it on. So thank you all for listening. Hope you are able to be yourself, encouraged to be yourself, as Mary Lou Williams encourages you to be. Let's all take her words to heart as we go forth and write the music that we have to write. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Take care, everybody.
Bye for now. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Arrangers Podcast.
If you enjoyed what you just heard, you can support us directly with a small donation on Patreon or by sharing this episode with a friend.
You can hear lots of other interviews, score studies, and fun discussions at www.thearrangerspodcast.com or wherever you find podcasts.
Bye for now, and keep writing.